voice. And for $10, we will be giving away some sweet CDs. So if you want to donate, please do not hesitate to contact CITR or phone in on 604-822-8648. I don't know if that still works, but another way to donate would be online through CITR.com. Enjoy the rest of your day, everyone.
CITR would like to congratulate Surrey's Ekamjeet Gooman, the recipient of this year's People's Choice Award for the World Cerebral Palsy Day Change the World in 1 Minute campaign, led by Cerebral Palsy Alliance. Cerebral palsy is a debilitating neuromotor condition that affects movement, muscle control, and balance, and occurs in 1 out of every 500 births. Ekamjeet, an SFU student who lives with cerebral palsy, proposed the idea of featuring models with the condition in advertising campaigns, which was voted the most popular idea by cerebral palsy associations all around the world. The Cerebral Palsy Association of British Columbia believes that such advertisements will provide much-needed public awareness for this condition, which is often misunderstood or misrecognized. By increasing public awareness, it hopes to see all who live with cerebral palsy participate fully in our community. For more information about the Cerebral Palsy Association of BC, which has supported the cerebral palsy community for over 60 years, please visit www.bccerebralpalsy.com. For more info about the World Cerebral Palsy Day, please visit www.worldcpday.org.
It's the Don't Trust Your Memory edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we take a look at end-of-life assistance and a look at memory. What is it, how it fails us, and how it's used to put innocent people in jail. And we close with Steve Pinker's Surprising End of Violence. A little web wisdom for you. Let's begin episode 288.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords from politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, I'd like to start the show by thanking all my generous listeners who donated hundreds of dollars to keep CITR on the air and improve the facilities that help make shows like Radio Freethinker possible. Thank you all very much. Well, the Supreme Court of Canada was very scientific in a recent ruling. The case in point was Carter v. Canada. In that decision, it ruled that doctor-assisted suicide, or perhaps more palatable, end-of-life assistance, is now legal. Sort of. It has given the laws of our land 1 year to reflect the new interpretation of the Constitution. This might prove to be a complicated rejiggering of law because the criminal code is subject to federal law, whereas health care is under provincial jurisdictions. This means that if the law is seen as a criminal act, it falls squarely under federal law, but if it's seen as health care of a sort, then it falls under provincial jurisdiction. Now, I started off by using the word scientific because in the 1993 Rodriguez v. British Columbia case, Rodriguez, a woman who was suffering from ALS, remember the ice bucket challenge? Yes, that disease. Well, she wished to end her life with dignity and not the way her condition, if allowed to play itself out, would have dictated. The court ruled 5-4 that the right to life, the sanctity of life, overruled her claims that living with her disease was cruel and unusual punishment. At the time, the key issue was the slippery slope issue. Her disability, the primary claim by Rodriguez as to why she needed assistance, you may not know this, but suicide is not illegal in this nation. Her claim being that she was discriminated against by reason of her disability, the ALS, that she was unable to exercise her right to suicide, and the law prohibiting assistance violated her right. The court, lacking substance or sufficient evidence, erred on the side of caution, saying the risk that the disabled could be manipulated into an early and unwanted death outweighed the right Rodriguez had to assistance. However, like science, When the information changes, when the weight of new evidence shifts from one conclusion to another, well, one does not insist dogmatically their view is written in stone. Their opinions change with the evidence. That is why this time the court ruled the original ruling in 1993 did not uphold the right to life, but imposed a duty to live. As such, the law prohibited end-of-life assistance, which violated a person's right to choose when to die. The argument regarding the slippery slope no longer provided the support it previously did, because as end-of-life assistance and euthanasia had become legal and common in a number of nations, such as Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, and Japan, and just south of the border, Washington and Oregon states, among others, well, based on these experiments, the concern that allowing for patients' choice will lead to a deluge of vulnerable persons being murdered has, well, it's not materialized. That it seems, under the right regulations, end-of-life assistance can be implemented in an effective, respectful, and responsible manner. So a big cheer to the Supreme Court. That said, previously on the show, we discussed end-of-life assistance with the aim of overturning the legislation. Now that it has been, we need to enter the next phase of the discussion. How exactly should we enact legislation to ensure the patient's right to death with dignity while protecting them from possible exploitation? What exploitation? Well, several arguments were raised prior to the repeal of the law, one being people will feel forced to end their life for financial reasons, that they're a burden on their families. How do we ensure the decision is not an impulse? For instance, someone who suffers a catastrophic injury, such as the loss of limbs or vision, may at the moment feel that they have no point in living. But as history has often shown, in time people adapt and go on to live fulfilled lives. There are concerns that a healthcare system under constant financial pressure will, either explicitly or implicitly, pressure patients to, how shall we put this, free up resources and beds for people who have a chance for a better outcome? Now is the time to address these concerns as we prepare to write legislation that will strike the balance between the good and the bad of end-of-life care. As already mentioned, the reason for the change of heart by the Supreme Court was the numerous jurisdictions that have already legalized end-of-life assistance. So we should take a look at how they have addressed these issues. I'd like to break this down into several questions. First, who should be allowed to access end-of-life assistance? Well, I think if you took a poll, most people would say that those who are terminally ill, those prospects of living less than a year, would be the kind of person for whom the average person would say that this service should be made available. Often, though, with the caveat that their last days would involve some form of physical pain or suffering. In fact, the laws enacted in the states of Washington and Oregon stipulate that the expectation of death be expected 6 months or sooner. That said, Netherlands sets the standards not at length of life, but quality. This is echoed in our own Supreme Court ruling that set the bar not at terminal illness, but enduring intolerable suffering. This would include not only terminal illnesses, but degenerative ones. Think about the prospect of someone suffering from Alzheimer's, where the body outlives a mind by years, even decades. In that kind of scenario, it is the suffering that marks the criteria for being eligible for assistance. Those who suffer from ALS or MS would also fall into this category. But if we include suffering, what of those who suffer from chronic depression, schizophrenia, any host of other debilitating psychological illness? Are we to include them? What of pedophilias or serial rapists who claim that they cannot live in a world where their urges cause them constant suffering? In Belgium, a prisoner successfully petitioned to be euthanized on the grounds that they would never be released from prison due to their uncontrollable urges, and the prospect of life in prison constituted suffering and thus qualified him for end-of-life assistance. In some places around the world, depression, or just a self-determined, carefully considered, and lasting decision made by a lucid person, is all that is required to qualify for end-of-life assistance. Canada may go down this road where only a well-considered decision of a person is needed to qualify, but currently it would likely be a triumvirate of the person in question, a doctor, and a psychologist, all agreeing. I myself think an individual has a right to end their life provided mechanisms are in place to ensure the well-considered part, and that I'm unsure how you would implement. So there needs to be a significant amount of thought concerning the conditions to be considered as causing, quote, enduring and intolerable suffering. Then there's another issue pertaining to age of consent. A few episodes back, we discussed a First Nations child who was deemed mature enough to, well, let's call it for what it was, she was deemed mature enough to kill herself. I made the point at the time that the refusal of treatment due to the belief that AltMed is better than real medicine was irresponsible. But if the end goal is to die with dignity, should her age be a barrier? Recently, Belgium reduced its age requirement. Every law I've seen stipulates that a patient must be a legal adult. Well, in Belgium, a child can request end-of-life assistance provided they are conscious of their decision and understand the meaning of euthanasia. It would be the responsible ability of a psychologist to determine if the child truly understood their request and whether the request is voluntary in nature. For adults, the material conditions are set as futile medical condition of constant and unbearable physical and mental suffering that cannot be alleviated. So the patient is suffering mentally or physically with no end to that suffering in sight. However, for children, the rules change in that their illness must be terminal, must be, quote, be in a hopeless medical situation of constant and unbearable suffering that cannot be eased and which will cause the death in short term. Of course, there must be agreement among the attending physician and, of course, consent from the parents. Although technically illegal in the Netherlands, it is allowed provided the groening process, which contains directives with criteria under which the physician can perform child euthanasia without fear of legal persecutions, is allowed, which basically is just an informal copy of the Belgian law. So the next question, should there be a distinction between assisting and performing the end act? It is, perhaps, one thing to provide someone with a poison that they themselves administer to end their life, and yet quite another if the provider is the one actually injecting the poison. Now, in general, most jurisdictions prohibit a person from killing another, be it requested or not. That what the law tends to allow is limited to providing the means for death. This, however, can be problematic. For instance, people who qualify for access to end-of-life assistance but are incapable of performing the act themselves, be they quadriplegic or locked-in syndrome or what have you. Are we going to allow a person to kill another person but only under medical supervision? And who would we get to perform this kind of assistance? Now, it seems like a small distinction between giving someone a gun to shoot themselves and being the one to pull the trigger, but newer psychological and philosophical experiments show that we see these as very different acts. And that leads to the next question. Who should be allowed to provide said assistance? Now, one might assume this assistance would be provided by your doctor, or a doctor. However, there are some problems with this approach. First, there's an ethical, I wouldn't call it a contradiction, but definitely a gray area where on Monday your doctor is doing everything to keep you alive, then on Wednesday they're assisting you to put yourself to death. Is this a conflict of interest? What kind of quandary is this? If you create a specialized class of healthcare providers whose job it is to ease one's exit from life, well, where's the assurance of integrity? That personal gain doesn't factor into the service. You know, try and drum up business for themselves. And of course, another question. How can we ensure that those accessing end-of-life assistance are not being manipulated or coerced? Well, this question is being addressed most commonly with two principles. First, the request must be repeated. Usually there are three requests, with two of those being in writing. The other principle is to ensure that what I would call outsiders are included. So, in addition to the doctor, there must be a number of witnesses, and at least one of those witnesses cannot be a family member or a member of the medical team. Kind of someone with an outside perspective, just to ensure that everything is being done above board. I think that Canada could enact a kind of ombudsman role, an arm's-length person, group, or agency that is both qualified to assess the medical conditions while maintaining independence from the participants. It might be called the informed stranger consent. So the above-mentioned group should be sufficient, and If we extend this to children, then of course some form of parental consent should also be included. I think there should be, as part of the criteria of the ombudsman I just mentioned, a role to assess or determine such questions as, who is availing themselves to the assistance? Are there any trends that should be investigated? Are there areas where the numbers seem excessive? Are there instances where people may be feeling pressure to end their lives? Are there instances where it is too difficult to exercise your right to die? Another question is the issue of how we ensure that we don't have the slippery slope, that the right to die doesn't become the duty to die. I think I covered this one with the idea of a euthanasia ombudsman, but there are some other arguments that maybe we should address. First is the Nazis. Yes, you knew at some point they would rear their ugly heads. So as many may or may not know, the Nazis first introduced euthanasia in 1939 as a way to remove defective people from the gene pool. At first, what qualified as defective were those suffering from serious hereditary diseases, such as Down syndrome, microcephaly, hyprocephaly, malformations of all kinds, especially of limbs, heads, and the spinal column, and paralysis, and things including spastic conditions. Okay, considering the medical knowledge of the time, the lack of knowledge about psychology or the pharmacological revolution at the time, you might not think this completely unreasonable, especially through the filter of eugenics that was quite common globally at the time. Of course, as you know now, what qualified as defective expanded to homosexuals and gypsies, then the communists, and eventually anyone not Aryan. Oh yes, and of course, the Jews. And remember, one of the horrors of the Nazi regime in Germany is the Germans of the time were well-educated, modern, a democratic society almost identical to England, France, and other, quote, moral societies, and yet it somehow saw its slippery slope end in a Holocaust. If it could happen to them, why not us? Well, I think history has answered this in the fact that as Germany went forward with eugenics, in most of the other parts of the world, by 1940, they turned against the practice. It was actually part of the dogma of Hitler that preserved it, amplified it in Germany. So in the same way that there were fascist movements in most nations, only in a couple did it take off. They were sort of exceptions to the rule. The same for communism. So I don't really think this is a strong argument, however emotive. The other is that certain segments of society will be pressured, either overtly or implicitly, to avail a premature death. These are usually seen as the elderly, the poor, the mentally challenged, or the disabled. Again, I think I addressed this with the ombudsman, but we have empirical evidence to draw upon. In the Netherlands, these vulnerable groups were studied, and the use of assistance in these groups were no more or less likely. The research shows that places where end-of-life assistance has been made legal, there have been no jumps in death rates. There's not been a eugenic thinning of the herd. In fact, most numbers I have seen point to euthanasia rates of about 1%. So we as a nation are about to add to the global experiment that is end-of-life assistance. I think it is high time that we allow people to have control not only over their lives, but also over their deaths. So on that cheerful note, let's kick back for a moment, relax, and we'll continue after this break.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
I like you all to sit back and think about the funniest thing that ever happened to you. Picture it in your mind. Now tell me about it. Okay, that doesn't quite work well in radio, but let me tell you this one time I was at a student conference, Youth Parliament. Well, being young and foolish, a group of us went out drinking after curfew. We got drunk, and upon returning to our bunks, we got caught by the supervisor. Well, telling us the consequences of our actions and the evils of our way, well, I threw up. And I just didn't throw up. I threw up all over the supervisor. I know, seems funny now, not so much at the time. I bet you're laughing, aren't you? There's only one problem. That didn't happen to me. It happened to one of my friends at the time. But I truly believed, at least for many years, that it was my memory and not his. I discovered this fact when, after a number of years of separation, thanks to Facebook, I reunited with this friend who was surprised to hear that his exploits had become mine. You might think, Don, did you just lie to us? Well, that depends on what you believe a lie is. To some, it is simply the retelling of an untrue event. And on that level, it's a fair cop. That said, research into memory would put a finer point on the term lie as a deliberate attempt to tell a falsehood or something untrue. And on that definition, emphasis on deliberate, I didn't lie. But I did not tell the truth either. The events, as I related them, did not in fact happen. But I thought they happened. And in that vein, there was no intent to mislead. It was my memory of this event that was untrue. I had experienced a false memory of sorts. Now, it may surprise you to know that those of you who recalled their funniest, scariest, etc. times, well, you as well may not be telling the whole truth. In fact, according to many experts, the vast majority perhaps, would tell you that every memory you have is false. Well, perhaps a more accurate way of saying it, your memories are at least partially false. Now, this is not because we like to put ourselves at the center of the action, although there is a tendency to do this, nor is it an attempt to make our stories more exciting or interesting, although again, we do have a tendency towards this. No, the way memory works, well, only a fool would trust it. And yet, it manages to get us through life. So let us explore, what is memory, how does it work, and how do we unintentionally or inevitably alter our recollections of events, places, and people? I should start by reminding my listeners that in many fundamental ways, we have no idea how memory works. That said, in many ways, we do have a handle, if not a complete working knowledge, of how memories are made, how we recall them, and what can go wrong in our mental archival system. Okay, what is memory? First, there are three levels in which memories are stored. The most basic and most fleeting is sensory memory. Then there's short-term memory, and lastly, long-term memory. Sensory memory is not what we normally think of as memory. It is more or less instantaneous, in the moment. It is the image that is recorded on the back of our eye, the sound we hear. This memory lasts seconds at best, and like watching a movie without a remote, the moment the scenes change, the sensory memory is replaced. Another way to think about sensory memory is to think of it as a buffer, holding something long enough for our brains to decide if we need to take a second look or not. It is also the part of memory where some visual effects occur, like when you do a flipbook animation. However fleeting this memory may be, it is the foundation of all the other memories we have. It is this memory, perhaps a more accurate term would be an image, that is transferred into the short-term memory. Now, our short-term memory requires a bit of effort. For example, recall the memory I asked you about earlier. You remember it now because you were thinking about it, repeating it in your mind. We usually experience short-term memory when we are trying to remember a number of a local cab company or a pizza joint. We likely say it a couple of times in our head. We make the call, and then it's gone. And no, even if you don't remember repeating it in your mind, you did. That crazy thing we like to call consciousness. Now, this memory can last minutes. Well, likely seconds, but who's counting? The problem with this kind of memory is that we really only have a limited number of memory slots. That is, most people could only remember 4 to 7 distinct bits at any one time. This leads to an effect called chunking, where we, often subconsciously, lump together bits of info into larger chunks. This is why it's easier to remember 1984 and 1867 than to remember 1984-1867. If I remember correctly, I just said that short-term memory lasts seconds to minutes. But this is a bit of a lie. No, not a lie, but part of the fuzzy. We are not completely sure. First, if we keep rehearsing, for example, saying the number over and over, it could remain in our short-term memory indefinitely. Some people also argue that there is no decay to this memory. It's simply replaced. So if we do not fill one or two of those memory slots, the residual memory could remain, again, indefinitely. This also leads to weird effects of short-term memory, the primacy effect and the residual effect. That is, we tend to remember the first few things at the beginning of the list, because they're the first, and we tend to repeat them in rehearsal mode more often. And then the last few things, we tend to remember more, because they're the last things we've stored in our memory. So, if you're asked to repeat a list, we tend to remember the first and last three items. The rest are almost always impossible, unless they get transferred to our long-term memory. Long-term memory is, as the name implies, long-term. Some stuff we will remember for our whole lives. Other stuff for a couple of days, depending on the how and the what of the memory. Okay, so that's sort of the three levels. But next, let's talk about long-term memory. There are two basic kinds of long-term memory. What I would call unconscious memory and conscious memory. By conscious memory, I mean memories we know we are memorizing. Things like what are the capital of the provinces, how to speak French, what kinds of memories we have. The unconscious type are what we sometimes call muscle memory. And no, muscles have no memory, but it is a kind of primal memory. And by primal and unconscious, I don't mean this kind of memory is easier to remember. It's just we don't think about memorizing. It happens independently of our wishes. The way I like to think of this is to recall the three layers of the brain, or at least the old school view of the brain, where you had the brain stem, or what they would call the reptilian brain, then you had the cerebellum, or the mammalian brain, then you would have the cerebral cortex, or the human part of the brain. I view conscious memory as the part that occurs in the human part of the brain, and unconscious in the rest of the brain. I say this because when a rat is put into a maze, or a pigeon is trained to press a lever, I don't believe that they think they are learning something, and yet they are. Maybe another way to think about this memory is that you don't need to think about remembering it. It is just remembered. Do you remember when you learned to tie your shoes? No, just one day you knew. Now you tie them without thinking about it at all. So unconscious memory itself is often broken down into two types. One is episodic. This is memory of an event that gets locked down. For example, you may not remember when the first time you put your hand into a fire, you felt the pain of a bee sting, but now whenever you see a fire, you know not to touch it, or why you freak out whenever a bee flies by. This is episodic memory. This kind of memory, from an evolutionary standpoint, is perhaps the most important. It is the most basic way to stay alive by not repeating past mistakes, or, to put a more positive spin, repeating things that are pleasurable. Yes, I'm talking about sex. The other kind is procedural, or what some call muscle memory. This is purposeful in that we learn something, but it's not something we think about. Again, think learning to play a song on a guitar, learning to walk. It took practice, but it's not like something we thought about doing. In fact, it's an odd case where we think a lot about how to do it before we memorize it, but if we actually started to think about how we did it after we memorize it, we'd likely screw it up. Okay. We now know where our memories are, kind of. What I've not yet talked about is how those memories are transferred from one layer to the next. And no, don't turn off yet. I don't actually plan to talk about it, at least not in any depth. So, science is not completely sure how memories are formed, but they do know the things that interfere with that transfer. Stress, fatigue, intoxication. We also know that perhaps in an attempt to be efficient or because of limitations of transfer, we often only store highlights, notes about the event. So you go to a party. You might have stored whose party it was, that there was food, and that there was a fight. But you didn't store the actual food menu, what people were wearing, the specific music. When you recall the party, if you ever do, your brain will fill in the details with what it guesses was right. And often, this is good enough. Okay, so this is only half of it. Psychologists now know that our memories are not written in stone, that every time we retrieve a memory, we're also altering that memory. Rather than load you down with the technical details, I will instead give you a description that has nothing to do with the biology of the brain, but will provide an excellent, if I do say so myself, explanation of what is going on. So when I retrieve a memory, I think of it as if I'm copying a spell from a magic book. And as everyone knows with magic, whenever you transfer a spell, the original is removed. So in my analogy, I have cut the memory from long-term storage and pasted it into short-term memory. Yes, magic and your computer work pretty much the same way. It is not that we forget memories we recall. What happens is that after the memory is done in short-term memory, it is again copied and pasted into long-term memory. Each time we cut and paste, we alter the memory. Most times these are benign changes, like in the aforementioned party. You do not remember what shoes you wore. Your brain fills in the blank with blue suede ones. When you paste the memory back, the added detail about your shoes is now added. Of course, someone might point out at a later date, after you told the story now with the blue suede shoes, perhaps a couple of times, that you didn't actually buy those shoes until a month after the party, that you could not have worn them at the party. And memory being as it is, you still recall the party with you in your Elvis shoes, even if you know it's a false memory. Now, many of you may recall that a well-known newscaster, Brian Williams, likely to be former host of NBC Nightly News, told the story about how he was in a helicopter that was shot and forced to land. When it was brought to his attention that he was not, in fact, in the chopper that was hit, but a falling one, he responded by claiming that he misremembered the events. This response was almost universally panned by the mass media, with many people saying things like, "How could you forget not getting shot out of the air?" or "You couldn't forget something that major." You even heard host emeritus Ethan make this claim on Radio Free Thinkers Fun Drive show last week. Well, first I should point out a logical fallacy. People said such a major event could not be forgotten. But remember, the whole controversy is that there was no major event. If, in fact, he was shot down and then said he didn't remember that, well, then their criticisms would have a point. The real question, is it possible to remember a major event that didn't happen? Completely different than what he's been accused of. And now that we've learned about how memories are formed, we can ask, did he lie, misremember, or was this just a false memory? Let us recall that when we form memories, often parts are altered, added, or deleted. The same thing with every time we recall and tell the story. Studies into eyewitness testimonies have shown that our memories cannot be trusted to recall major parts of an event. For example, what color was the thief's jacket? Were there broken windows, etc.? In fact, a recent experiment I heard about had a group of people watch a video of a car accident. They were then divided into two groups. Both groups were asked to estimate the speed of the cars involved. One group was asked thusly, estimate the speed at the time the two cars hit each other. The other group were asked, estimate the time of speed the two cars crashed into each other. The second group estimated a significantly faster speed than the first group. More telling, a week after seeing the video, the two groups were asked if there was any broken glass at the scene. The first group said no. The majority of those in the second group did recall seeing broken glass. For the record, there was no actual broken glass. The priming effect of the word crash induced the participants in the second group to add contextually appropriate details, irrespective of whether those details are really there or not. When we think of car crashes, we think of broken glass. We also will misattribute things. Have you ever told a joke to a person who originally told it to you? As time goes by, our memories fade and become hazy. When we recall them, more and more details tend to be altered to fill in the gaps or to just justify the expectations of the listener. And here we return to Brian Williams. When he first reported the story, he said he was in the following helicopter and not in the one that was hit. It was not until a few years later, someone else talking about the incident moved Brian from the following copter to the one that was shot. It was only after this misattribution that Brian started to recall the events differently. And let us remember, this is not something he was talking about every day, 2 or 4 times a year, if that. Lots of time in between for the details to get hazy. And he may have been quoted correctly in his initial telling, and then someone saying, "I thought it was your plane that got hit." And, not being sure, he may have responded, "Oh, really? Funny what time can do to your memory." And from that point onward, his memory of the events were false, or at least altered. I'm sure that, from his perspective, the responses, the events that occurred in his chopper and the hit chopper were the same. Lots of fear, confusion, the fear of being killed. His chopper was forced down for fear of being destroyed, shot or not. It was a traumatic event for him. So we can all agree that his latest recalling of events was not true. It was not a false memory in the sense that the events did occur, and he was part of the event, but it was definitely altered memory. But was it a lie? To be a lie, there must be some intent, and there seems to be no reason to fabricate his accounts. Yes, it does spice up a bit, and we've all embellished our past adventures, but to tell a story that your own reporting reputes, well, it seems to lack intent from my perspective. This story also has a darker side. I mentioned that a lot of research has gone into how recollection of events can be inaccurate and, more importantly, altered by that recollection. Well, not only can we change our memories, but those around us can also alter them. Researchers, in an attempt to see if they could get people to falsely confess to crimes, showed that it was a very easy thing to do. The researchers got some information from parents and other family members about the childhood events of the participants. They then asked the participants to recall details about specific events that their family had shared with the researchers. The participants knew from where the researchers had obtained the information, and that's an important fact. The participants were told about an event in their past that did not happen, that it involved the police. They seeded the event with true information, like the name of their best friend at the time, etc. Then said the incident was serious enough for the police to contact their parents, ergo how the parents knew about the event. They found that almost all people, eventually, were recalling a completely fictitious event. They were adding details and expanding upon the story. This was a false memory. I said eventually, because some needed a bit of prodding. Well, first they all knew on the surface that they did not remember the event as it was told to them, obviously. But they also did not think their parents would lie about something like that. The researchers helped things along for those more reticent by helping them with techniques to retrieve repressed memories, quote unquote. Techniques the researchers knew only helped form and reinforce the false memory. And you might say, wow, what an interesting piece of research. Who knew the mind was so malleable? That is until you realize that this is often happening in interrogation rooms at police stations around the world. You see, most people like to get along. If a cop says he knows you were at such and such a place, you kind of want to agree, even if you're sure you were elsewhere. But even more so, if you don't really remember where you were exactly at 9:45 p.m. on the evening of Tuesday, the 15th of 2011. As more time passes, the events of our memory begin to fade. Now, you might say, if I thought going along with the cop might lead to death row, I would never agree with the false story. And well, this plays into prosecution's hands. Why? Well, they would always give you a way out. They might say something like, "Listen, I know you want to do the right thing. If only you could remember and confess, we could stop all this. Admit to second-degree murder, and I'll promise no death penalty. Spend a few years in prison, and you have the rest of your life to live. But if you continue this stonewalling, I'll be forced to press first-degree murder charges. And then your fate, your life, is in the hands of the jury, and we both know the evidence shows you were at this place at that time. Under those circumstances, who knows what you might say?" Now, I'm not saying the cops are necessarily using memory tricks on purpose, but how many times have you heard the line, "Okay, one more time. Tell me exactly what happened. Do you remember seeing X?" It does not seem a far stretch to see how people will confess to a crime they did not commit, and after hours of relentless interrogation and trial, they may actually start to believe they did it. Remember my funny story at the beginning of this segment? I add trial because it's not only the accused who are vulnerable to this false or altered memory effect. witnesses as well are just as likely to remember things the way the cops want them to. And I'm not just picking on cops. I'm sure defense attorneys use the same trick. That said, there are likely a significant number of innocent people in jail right now for a crime they had nothing to do with. Kind of makes you think. So, can we trust our memories? Short answer is no. But it works good enough to let us go through life without too many pitfalls. It is not likely the case you'll be accused of a crime, be a witness at a trial. When you tell your friends about that party 5 years ago, most people will not try and fact-check you. For that matter, most of us do not have video recordings of our everyday waking moments. Not yet, at least, Google be praised. So when your memories are altered, there's no way for us to check them out to see if they were or not, even if we wanted to. And on that note, we're going to take a break and come back with a bit of web wisdom.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
And we're back. We're going to end the show with Steve Pinker's TED Talk about the surprising decline in violence, contrary to what you'd get from Herr Harper and his conservative goons. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on, and again, thanks all who donated.
Images like this from the Auschwitz concentration camp have been seared into our consciousness during the 20th century and have given us a new understanding of who we are, where we've come from, and the times we live in. During the 20th century, we witnessed the atrocities of Stalin, Hitler, Mao, Pol Pot, Rwanda, and other genocides. And even though the 21st century is only 7 years old, we have already witnessed an ongoing genocide in Darfur and the daily horrors of Iraq. This has led to a common understanding of our situation, namely that modernity has brought us terrible violence, and perhaps that native peoples lived in a state of harmony that we have departed from to our peril. Here's an example from an op-ed on Thanksgiving in the Boston Globe a couple of years ago, where the writer wrote, "The Indian life was a difficult one, but there was no employment problems, community harmony was strong, substance abuse unknown, crime nearly non-existent. What warfare there was between tribes was largely ritualistic and seldom resulted in indiscriminate or wholesale slaughter." Now, you're all familiar with this treacle. We teach it to our children. We hear it on television in storybooks. Now, the original title of this session was Everything You Know Is Wrong, and I'm going to present evidence that this particular part of our common understanding is wrong, that in fact our ancestors were far more violent than we are, that violence has been in decline for long stretches of time, and that today we are probably living in the most peaceful time in our species' existence. Now, in the decade of Darfur and Iraq, a statement like that might seem somewhere between hallucinatory and obscene, but I'm going to try to convince you that that is the correct picture. The decline of violence is a fractal phenomenon. You can see it over millennia, over centuries, over decades, and over years, although there seems to have been a tipping point at the onset of the Age of Reason in the 16th century. One sees it all over the world, although not homogeneously. It's especially evident in the West, beginning with England and Holland around the time of the Enlightenment. Let me take you on a journey from several powers of 10 from the millennium scale to the year scale to try to persuade you of this. Until 10,000 years ago, all humans lived as hunter-gatherers without permanent settlements or government. And this is the state that's commonly thought to be one of primordial harmony. But the archaeologist Lawrence Keeley, looking at casualty rates among contemporary hunter-gatherers, namely, which is our best source of evidence about this way of life, has shown a rather different conclusion. Here's a graph that he put together showing the percentage of male deaths due to warfare in a number of foraging or hunting and gathering societies. The red bars correspond to the likelihood that a man will die at the hands of another man, as opposed to passing away of natural causes, in a variety of foraging societies in the New Guinea highlands and the Amazon rainforest. And they range from a rate of almost a 60% chance that a man will die at the hands of another man to, in the case of the Gabuski, only a 15% chance. The tiny little blue bar in the lower left-hand corner plots the corresponding statistic from the United States and Europe in the 20th century, and it includes all the deaths of both world wars. If the death rate in tribal warfare had prevailed during the 20th century, there would have been 2 billion deaths rather than 100 million. Also on the millennium scale, we can look at the way of life of early civilizations, such as the ones described in the Bible. And in this supposed source of our moral values, one can read descriptions of what was expected in warfare, such as the following from Numbers 31. And they warred against the Midianites as the Lord commanded Moses, and they slew all the males. And Moses said unto them, Have you saved all the women alive? Now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that hath known man by lying with him, but all the women children that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. In other words, kill the men, kill the children. If you see any virgins, then you can keep them alive so that you can rape them. And you can find 4 or 5 passages in the Bible of this ilk. Also in the Bible, one sees that the death penalty was the accepted punishment for crimes such as homosexuality, adultery, blasphemy, idolatry, talking back to your parents, and picking up sticks on the Sabbath. Well, let's click the zoom lens down one order of magnitude and look at the century scale. Now, although we don't have statistics for warfare throughout the Middle Ages to modern times, we know just from conventional history that the evidence was under our nose all along that there has been a reduction in socially sanctioned forms of violence. For example, any social history will reveal that mutilation and torture were routine forms of criminal punishment. The kind of infraction today that would give you a fine in those days would result in your tongue being cut out, your ears being cut off, you being blinded, a hand being chopped off, and so on. There were numerous ingenious forms of sadistic capital punishment, burning at the stake, disemboweling, breaking on the wheel, being pulled apart by horses, and so on. The death penalty was sanctioned for a long list of nonviolent crimes, criticizing the king, stealing a loaf of bread. Slavery, of course, was the preferred labor-saving device, and cruelty was a popular form of entertainment. Perhaps the most vivid example was the practice of cat burning, in which a cat was hoisted on a stage, lowered in a sling into a fire, and the spectators shrieked in laughter as the cat, howling in pain, was burned to death. What about one-on-one murder? Well, there are good statistics, because many municipalities recorded the cause of death, and the criminologist Manuel Eisner scoured all of the historical records across Europe for homicide rates in any village, hamlet, town, county that he could find, and then he supplemented them with national data when nations started keeping statistics. He plotted on a logarithmic scale from a 100, going from 100 deaths per 100,000 people per year, which was approximately the rate of homicide in the Middle Ages, and the figure plummets down to less than one homicide per 100,000 people per year in seven or eight European countries. Then there was a slight uptick in the 1960s. The people who said that rock and roll would lead to the decline of moral values actually had a grain of truth to that. But there was a decline from at least two orders of magnitude in homicide from the Middle Ages to the present, and the elbow occurred in the early 16th century. Well, let's click down now to the decade scale. According to non-governmental organizations that keep such statistics, since 1945 in Europe and the Americas, there's been a steep decline in interstate wars, in deadly ethnic riots or pogroms, and in military coups, even in South America. Worldwide, there's been a steep decline in deaths in interstate wars. The yellow bars here show the number of deaths per war per year from 1950 to the present. And as you can see, the death rate goes down from 65,000 deaths per conflict per year in the 1950s to less than 2,000 deaths per conflict per year in this decade, as horrific as it is. Even in the year scale, one can see a decline of violence. Since the end of the Cold War, there have been fewer civil wars, fewer genocides, indeed a 90% reduction since post-World War II highs, and even a reversal of the 1960s uptick in homicide and violent crime. This is from the FBI Uniform Crime Statistics. You can see that there was a fairly low rate of violence in the 50s and the 60s. Then it soared upward for several decades and began a precipitous decline starting in the 1990s, so that it went back almost back to the level that was last enjoyed in 1960. President Clinton, if you're here, thank you. So the question is, why are so many people so wrong about something so important? I think there are a number of reasons. One of them is we have better reporting. The Associated Press is a better chronicler of wars over the surface of the earth than 16th century monks were. There's a cognitive illusion. We cognitive psychologists know that the easier it is to recall specific instances of something, the higher the probability that you assign to it. Things that we read about in the paper with gory footage burn into memory more than reports of a lot more people dying in their beds of old age. There are dynamics in the opinion and advocacy markets. No one ever attracted observers, advocates and donors by saying things just seem to be getting better and better. There's guilt about our treatment of native peoples in modern intellectual life, and an unwillingness to acknowledge there could be anything good about Western culture. And of course, our change in standards can outpace the change in behavior. One of the reasons violence went down is that people got sick of the carnage and cruelty in their time. That's a process that seems to be continuing, but if it outstrips behavior, by the standards of the day, things always look more barbaric than they would have been by historic standards. So today we get exercised, and rightly so, if a handful of murderers get executed by lethal injection in Texas after a 15-year appeal process, we don't consider that a couple of hundred years ago they may have been burned at the stake for criticizing the king after a trial that lasted 10 minutes, and indeed that would have been repeated over and over again. Today we look at capital punishment as evidence as of how low our behavior can sink rather than how high our standards have risen. Well, why has violence declined? No one really knows, but I have read four explanations, all of which I think have some grain of plausibility. The first is, maybe Thomas Hobbes got it right. He was the one who said that life in a state of nature was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Not because, he argued, humans have some primordial thirst for blood or aggressive instinct or territorial imperative, but because of the logic of anarchy. In a state of anarchy, there's a constant temptation to invade your neighbors preemptively before they invade you. More recently, Thomas Schelling gives the analogy of a homeowner who hears a rustling in the basement. Being a good American, he has a pistol in the nightstand, pulls out his gun, walks down the stairs, and what does he see but a burglar with a gun in his hand? Now, each one of them is thinking, I don't really want to kill that guy, but he's about to kill me. Maybe I had better shoot him before he shoots me, especially since since even if he doesn't want to kill me, he's probably worrying right now that I might kill him before he kills me, and so on. Hunter-gatherer peoples explicitly go through this train of thought and will often raid their neighbors out of fear of being raided first. Now, one way of dealing with this problem is by deterrence. You don't strike first, but you have a publicly announced policy that you will retaliate savagely if you are invaded. The only thing that is that it's likely liable to having its bluff called, and therefore can only work if it's credible. To make it credible, you must avenge all insults and settle all scores, which leads to the cycles of bloody vendetta. Life becomes an episode of The Sopranos. Hobbes's solution, the Leviathan, was that if authority for the legitimate use of violence was vested in a single democratic agency, a Leviathan, then such a state can reduce the temptation of attack because any kind of aggression will be punished, leaving its profitability as zero. That would remove the temptation to invade preemptively out of fear of them attacking you first. It removes the need for a hair trigger for retaliation to make your deterrent threat credible, and therefore it would lead to a state of peace. Eisner, the man who plotted the homicide rates that you failed to see in the earlier slide, argued that the timing of the decline of homicide in Europe coincided with the rise of centralized states. So that's a bit of a support for the Leviathan theory. Also supporting it is the fact that we today see eruptions of violence in zones of anarchy, in failed states, collapsed empires, frontier regions, mafias, street gangs, and so on. The second explanation is that in many times and places, there is a widespread sentiment that life is cheap. In earlier times, when suffering and early death were common in one's own life, one has fewer compunctions about inflicting them on others. And as technology and economic efficiency make life longer and more pleasant, one puts a higher value on life in general. This was an argument from the political scientist James Payne. A third explanation invokes the concept of a non-zero-sum game and was worked out in the book Non-Zero by the journalist Robert Wright. Wright points out that in certain circumstances, cooperation or nonviolence can benefit both parties in an interaction, such as gains in trade when two parties trade their surpluses and both come out ahead, or when two parties lay down their arms and split the so-called peace dividend that results in them not having to fight the whole time. Wright argues that technology has increased the number of positive-sum games that humans tend to be embroiled in by allowing the trade of goods, services, and ideas over longer distances and among larger groups of people. The result is that other people become more valuable alive than dead, and violence declines for selfish reasons. As Wright put it, among the many reasons that I think that we should not bomb the Japanese is that they built my minivan. The fourth explanation is captured in the title of a book called The Expanding Circle by the philosopher Peter Singer, who argues that evolution bequeathed humans with a sense of empathy, an ability to treat other people's interests as comparable to one's own. Unfortunately, by default, we apply it only to a very narrow circle of friends and family. People outside that circle are treated as subhuman and can be exploited with impunity. But over history, the circle has expanded. One can see in historical record it expanding from the village to the clan, to the tribe, to the nation, to other races, to both sexes, and in Singer's own argument, something that we should extend to other sentient species. So the question is, if this has happened, what has powered that expansion? And there are a number of possibilities, such as increasing circles of reciprocity in the sense that Robert Wright argues for. The logic of the golden rule, the more you think about and interact with other people, the more you realize that it is untenable to privilege your interests over theirs, at least not if you want them to listen to you. You can't say that my interests are special compared to yours any more than you can say that the particular spot that I'm standing on is a unique part of the universe because I happen to be standing on it that very minute. It may also be powered by cosmopolitanism, by histories and journalism and memoirs and realistic fiction and travel and literacy, which allows you to project yourself into the lives of other people that formerly you may have treated as subhuman, and also to realize the accidental contingency of your own station in life, the sense that there but for fortune go I. Well, whatever its causes, the decline